Chapter 9. It was past 5, and several guests had already arrived before the host himself got home. He went in together with Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev and Pestsov, who had reached the street door at the same moment. These were the two leading representatives of the Moscow intelligentsia, as Oblonsky had called them. Both were men respected for their character and their intelligence. They respected each other, but were in complete and hopeless disagreement upon almost every subject, not because they belonged to opposite parties, but precisely because they were of the same party. Their enemies refused to see any distinction between their views, but in that party each had his own special shade of opinion. And since no difference is less easily overcome than the difference of opinion about semi-abstract questions, they never agreed in any opinion, and had long, indeed, been accustomed to jeer without anger each at the other's incorrigible aberrations. They were just going in at the door, talking of the weather, when Stepan Arkadyevitch overtook them. Prince Alexander Dmitrievich Shishchabatsky, Oblonsky's father-in-law, young Shishchabatsky, Turovtsin, Kitty, and Karenin were already in the drawing-room. Stepan Arkadyevitch saw immediately that things were not going well in the drawing-room without him. Darya Alexandrovna, in her best grey silk gown, obviously worried about the children, who were to have their dinner by themselves in the nursery, and by her husband's absence, was not equal to the task of making the party mix without him. All were sitting like so many priests' daughters on a visit, so the old prince expressed it, obviously wondering why they were there, and pumping up remarks simply to avoid being silent. Turovtsin, good, simple man, felt unmistakably like a fish out of water, and the smile with which his thick lips greeted Stepan Arkadyevitch said as plainly as words, "Well, dear fellow, you have put me down in a bunch of brains. A drinking party now, or the Chateau des Fleurs would be more in my line." The old prince sat in silence, his bright little eyes watching Karenin from one side, and Stepan Arkadyevitch saw he had already formed a phrase to sum up that politician of whom guests were invited to partake as though he were a sturgeon. Kitty was looking at the door, calling up all her energies to keep from blushing at the entrance of Konstantin Levin. Young Shishchabatsky, who had not been introduced to Karenin, was trying to look as though he were not in the least conscious of it. Karenin himself had followed the Petersburg fashion for a dinner with ladies, and was wearing evening dress and a white tie. Stepan Arkadyevitch saw by his face that he had come simply to keep his promise, and was performing a disagreeable duty in being present at this gathering. He was indeed the person chiefly responsible for the chill benumbing all the guests before Stepan Arkadyevitch came in. On entering the drawing-room, Stepan Arkadyevitch apologized, explaining that he had been detained by that prince who was always the scapegoat for all his absences and latenesses, and in one moment he had made all the guests acquainted with each other, and bringing together Alexei Alexandrovich and Sergei Koznishev, he started them on a discussion of the Russification of Poland, into which they immediately plunged with Pestsov. Slapping Turovtsin on the shoulder, he whispered something comic in his ear, set him down by his wife and the old prince. Then he told Kitty she was looking very pretty that evening, and presented Shishchabatsky to Karenin. In a moment he had so kneaded together the social dough that the drawing-room became very lively, and there was a merry buzz of voices. Konstantin Levin was the only person who had not arrived, but this was so much the better, as going into the dining-room, Stepan Arkadyevitch found to his horror that the port and sherry had been procured from Desprez and not from Levée, and directing that the coachman should be sent off as speedily as possible to Levée's, he started back to the drawing-room. In the dining-room, he was met by Konstantin Levin. "I'm not late."
"You can never help being late," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, taking his arm.
"Have you a lot of people? Who's here?" asked Levin, unable to help blushing as he knocked the snow off his cap with his glove.
"All our own people. Kitty's here. Come along. I'll introduce you to Karenin."
Stepan Arkadyevitch, for all his liberal views, was well aware that to meet Karenin was sure to be felt a flattering distinction, and so treated his best friend to this honour. But at that instant, Konstantin Levin was not in condition to feel all the gratification of making such an acquaintance. He had not seen Kitty since that memorable evening when he met Vronsky, not counting, that is, the moment when he had had a glimpse of her on the high road. He had known at the bottom of his heart that he would see her here today,
but to keep his thoughts free, he had tried to persuade himself that he didn't know it. Now, when he heard that she was here, he was suddenly conscious of such delight, and at the same time of such dread, that his breath failed him, and he couldn't utter what he wanted to say. "What is she like? What's she like? Like what she used to be, or like what she was in the carriage? What if Darya Alexandrovna told the truth? Why shouldn't it be the truth?" he thought. "Oh, please, introduce me to Karenin," he said with an effort. And with a desperately determined step, he walked into the drawing-room and beheld her. She was not the same as she used to be, nor was she as she had been in the carriage. She was quite different. She was frightened, shy, shame-faced, and still more charming because of it. She saw him the very instant he walked into the room. She'd been expecting him. She was delighted, and so confused at her own delight, that there was a moment, the moment when he went up to her sister and glanced again at her, when she, and he, and Dolly, who saw it all, thought she would break down and would begin to cry. She crimsoned, turned white, crimsoned again, and grew faint, waiting with quivering lips for him to come to her. He went up to her, bowed, and held out his hand without speaking. Except for the slight quiver of her lips and the moisture in her eyes that made them brighter, her smile was almost calm as she said, "How long it is since we've seen each other!" And with desperate determination she pressed his hand with her cold hand. "You've not seen me, but I've seen you," said Levin, with a radiant smile of happiness. "I saw you when you were driving from the railway station to Yagushova." "When?" she asked, wondering. "You were driving to Yagushova," said Levin, feeling as if he would sob with the rapture that was flooding his heart. How dared I associate anything not innocent with this touching creature? "And yes, I do believe it's true what Darya Alexandrovna told me," he thought. Stepan Arkadyevitch took him by the arm and led him away to Karenin. "Let me introduce you." He mentioned their names. "Very glad to meet you again," said Alexei Alexandrovitch coldly, shaking hands with Levin. "You're acquainted?" Stepan Arkadyevitch asked in surprise. "We spent 3 hours together in the train," said Levin, smiling, "but got out, just as in a masquerade, quite mystified. Well, at least I was." "Nonsense! Come along, please," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, pointing in the direction of the dining room. The men went into the dining room and went up to a table laid with 6 kinds of vodka and as many kinds of cheese, some with little silver spades and some without, caviars, herrings, preserves of various kinds, and plates with slices of French bread. The men stood around the fragrant vodkas and appetizers, and the discussion of the Russification of Poland between Koznishev, Karenin, and Pestsov died down in anticipation of dinner. Sergei Ivanovitch was unequalled in his skill in winding up the most heated and serious argument by some unexpected pinch of Attic salt, his dry, graceful wit, that changed the disposition of his opponent. He did this now. Alexei Alexandrovitch had been maintaining that the Russification of Poland could be accomplished only as a result of highest principles, which ought to be introduced by the Russian government. Pestsov insisted that one country can assimilate only when it is more densely populated. Koznishev admitted both points, but with limitations. As they were going out of the drawing-room to conclude the argument, Koznishev said, smiling, "So then, for the Russification of our foreign populations, there is but one method, to bring up as many children as you can. My brother and I are terribly at fault, I see. You married men, especially you, Stepan Arkadyevitch, are the real patriots. How many of you?" he said, smiling genially at their host and holding out a tiny vodka glass to him. Everyone laughed, and Stepan Arkadyevitch with particular good humour. "Oh, yes, that's the best method," he said, munching cheese and filling the glass before him with a special sort of vodka. The conversation dropped at the jest. "This cheese isn't bad. Shall I give you some?" said the host. "Why, have you been going in for gymnastics again?" he asked Levin, pinching his muscle with his left hand. Levin smiled, bent his arm,
and under Stepan Arkadyevitch's fingers the muscles bulged like a Dutch cheese, hard as steel, through the fine cloth of the coat.
"What biceps? A real Samson!" "I imagine great strength is needed for hunting bears," observed Alexei Alexandrovitch, who had only the mistiest notions about hunting. He cut off and spread with cheese a thin slice of bread, fine as a cobweb.
Levin smiled.
"Not at all. Quite the contrary. A child can kill a bear," he said, with a slight bow, moving aside for the ladies who were approaching the table.
"You've killed a bear, I've been told," said Kitty, vainly trying to catch with her fork a perverse mushroom that would slip away, and setting the lace quivering over her white arm. "Are there bears on your place?" she added, turning her lovely little head to him and smiling. There was apparently nothing extraordinary in what she said, but what unutterable meaning there was for him in every sound, in every turn of her lips, her eyes, her hand as she said it. There was entreaty for forgiveness, and trust in him, and tenderness, soft, timid tenderness, and promise, and hope, and love for him, which he could not but believe in, and which choked him with happiness.
"No, we've been hunting in the Tverskoy province. It was coming back from there that I met your beau-frère in the train, or your beau-frère's brother-in-law," he said with a smile. "It was an amusing meeting."
And he began telling, with droll good humour, how, after not sleeping all night, he had, wearing an old sheep-lined coat, got into Alexei Alexandrovitch's compartment.
"The conductor, regardless of the proverb, you know, upon meeting you're judged by your clothes, upon parting you're judged by your wits, would have chucked me out on account of my attire. But thereupon I began expressing my feelings in fancy language, and—" "You too," he said, addressing Karenin and forgetting his name, "at first would have ejected me because of the old coat, but afterwards you took my part, for which I am extremely grateful."
"The rights of passengers generally to choose their seats are too ill-defined," said Alexei Alexandrovitch, rubbing the tips of his fingers on his handkerchief.
"I saw you were uncertain about me," said Levin, smiling good-naturedly. "But I made haste to plunge into intellectual conversation to smooth over the defects of my attire."
Sergei Ivanovitch, while keeping up a conversation with their hostess, had one ear cocked for his brother, and he glanced askance at him. "What's the matter with him today? Why such a conquering hero?" he thought. He didn't know that Levin was feeling as though he had grown wings. Levin knew she was listening to his words, and that she was glad to listen to him. And this was the only thing that interested him. Not in that room only, but in the whole world, there existed for him only himself, with enormously increased importance and dignity in his own eyes, and her. He felt himself on a pinnacle that made him giddy, and far away, down below, were all those nice, excellent Karenins, Oblonskys, and all the world. Quite without attracting notice, without glancing at them, as though there were no other places left, Stepan Arkadyevitch seated Levin and Kitty side by side.
"Oh, you may as well sit here," he said to Levin.
The dinner was as choice as the china, of which Stepan Arkadyevitch was a connoisseur. The potage Marie-Louise was a splendid success. The tiny pies eaten with it melted in the mouth and were irreproachable. The two footmen and Matveyi, in white cravats, did their duty with the dishes and wines unobtrusively, quietly and swiftly. On the material side, the dinner was a success. It was no less so on the non-material. The conversation, at times general, and at times between individuals, never ceased, and toward the end, the company was so lively that the men rose from the table still talking, and even Alexei Alexandrovitch thawed. Chapter 10 Pestsov liked thrashing an argument out to a conclusion, and was not satisfied with Sergei Ivanovitch's words, especially as he felt the injustice of his view.
"I didn't mean," he said over the soup, addressing Alexei Alexandrovitch, "mere density of population alone, but in conjunction with fundamental ideas, and not by means of principles."
"It seems to me," Alexei Alexandrovitch said languidly and with no haste, "that's the same thing. In my opinion, influence over another people is possible only to the people which has the higher development, which...
But that's just the question, Pestsov broke in his bass. He was always in a hurry to speak, and seemed always to put his whole soul into what he was saying.
Of what are we to make higher development consist? The English, the French, the Germans. Which is at the highest state of development? Which of them will nationalize the other? We see the Rhine provinces have been turned French, but the Germans are not at a lower stage, he shouted. There is another law at work there.
I imagine that the greater influence is always on the side of true civilization, said Alexei Alexandrovitch, slightly lifting his eyebrows.
But what are we to lay down as the outward signs of true civilization? Said Pestsov.
I imagine such signs are generally very well known, said Alexei Alexandrovitch.
But are they fully known? Sergei Ivanovitch put in with a subtle smile.
It is the accepted view now that real culture must be purely classical. But we see most intense disputes on either side of the question, and there's no denying that the opposite camp has strong points in its favour.
You're a classicist, Sergei Ivanovitch. Will you have red wine? Said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
I'm not expressing my own opinion of either form of culture, Sergei Ivanovitch said, holding out his glass with a smile of condescension, as to a child. I only say that both sides have strong arguments to support them, he went on, addressing Alexei Alexandrovitch. My sympathies are classical from education, but in this discussion I am personally unable to arrive at a conclusion. I see no distinct grounds for classical studies being given a preeminence over scientific studies.
The natural sciences have just as great an educational value, put in Pestsov. Take astronomy, take botany or zoology with its system of general laws.
I cannot quite agree with that, responded Alexei Alexandrovitch. It seems to me that one must admit that the very process of studying the forms of language has a peculiarly favourable influence on intellectual development. Moreover, it cannot be denied that the influence of the classical authors is in the highest degree moral. While, unfortunately, with the study of the natural sciences are associated the false and noxious doctrines, which are the curse of our day.
Sergei Ivanovitch would have said something, but Pestsov interrupted him in his rich bass. He began warmly contesting the justice of this view. Sergei Ivanovitch waited serenely to speak, obviously with a convincing reply ready.
"But," said Sergei Ivanovitch, smiling subtly and addressing Karenin, "one must admit that to weigh all the advantages and disadvantages of classical and scientific education is a difficult task, and the question of which form of education is preferable would not have been so quickly and conclusively decided if there had not been in favour of classical education, as you expressed it just now, its moral, disons le mot, anti-nihilist influence."
Undoubtedly.
If it had not been for the distinctive property of anti-nihilistic influence on the side of classical studies, we should have considered the subject more, have weighed the arguments on both sides, said Sergei Ivanovitch with a subtle smile. We should have given elbow room to both tendencies. But now we know that these little pills of classical learning possess the medicinal property of anti-nihilism, and we boldly prescribe them to our patients. But what if they had no such medicinal property, he wound up, sprinkling his Attic salt. At Sergei Ivanovitch's little pills, everyone laughed. Turovtsin especially roared loudly and jovially, glad at last to have found something to laugh at, all he ever looked for in listening to conversation.
Stepan Arkadyevitch had not made a mistake in inviting Pestsov. With Pestsov, intellectual conversation never flagged for an instant. As soon as Sergei Ivanovitch had concluded the conversation with his jest, Pestsov promptly started a new one.
"I can't agree even," said he, "that the government had that aim. The government, obviously, is guided by abstract considerations, and remains indifferent to the influence its measures may exercise. The education of women, for instance, would naturally be regarded as likely to be harmful, but the government opens schools and universities for women."
And the conversation at once passed to the new subject of the education of women. Alexei Alexandrovitch expressed the idea that the education of women is apt to be confused with the emancipation of women, and that it is only so that it can be considered dangerous.
"I consider, on the contrary, that the two questions are inseparably connected together," said Petzov. "It is a vicious circle. Woman is deprived of rights from lack of education, and the lack of education results from the absence of rights. We must not forget that the subjection of women is so complete, and dates from such ages back, that we are often unwilling to recognize the gulf that separates them from us," said he. "You said rights," said Sergei Ivanovitch, waiting till Pestsov had finished, "meaning the right of sitting on juries, of voting, of presiding at official meetings, the right of entering the civil service, of sitting in Parliament. Undoubtedly. But if women, as a rare exception, can occupy such positions, it seems to me you are wrong in using the expression rights. It would be more correct to say duties. Every man will agree that in performing the functions of a juryman, a town councillor, a telegraph clerk, we feel we are performing duties. And therefore, it would be correct to say that women are seeking duties, and quite legitimately. And one can sympathize with this desire to assist in the general labor of man." "Quite so," Alexei Alexandrovitch assented. "The question, I imagine, is simply whether they are fitted for such duties."
"They will most likely be perfectly fitted," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, "when education has become general among them. We see this..."
"How about the proverb?"
said the prince, who had a long while been intent on the conversation, his little comical eyes twinkling.
"I can say it before my daughters. Her hair is long because her wit is short."
"Just what they thought of the Negroes before their emancipation," said Petzov angrily.
"What seems strange to me is that women should seek fresh duties," said Sergei Ivanovitch, "while we see, unhappily, that men usually try to avoid them."
"Duties are bound up with rights, power, money, honour. Those are what women are seeking," said Petzov.
"Just as though I should seek the right to be a wet nurse and feel injured because women are paid for the work, while no one will take me," said the old prince.
Turovtsin exploded in a loud roar of laughter, and Sergei Ivanovitch regretted that he had not made this comparison. Even Alexei Alexandrovitch smiled.
"Yes, but a man can't nurse a baby," said Petzov, "while a woman..." "No, there was an Englishman who did suckle his baby on board ship," said the old prince, feeling this freedom in conversation permissible before his own daughters.
"There are as many such Englishmen as there would be women officials," said Sergei Ivanovitch.
"Yes, but what is a girl to do who has no family?"
put in Stepan Arkadyevitch, thinking of Masha Chibisova, whom he had had in mind all along in sympathizing with Petzov and supporting him.
"If the story of such a girl were thoroughly sifted, you would find she had abandoned a family, her own or a sister's, where she might have found a woman's duties,"
Darya Alexandrovna broke in unexpectedly, in a tone of exasperation, probably suspecting what sort of girl Stepan Arkadyevitch was thinking of.
"But we take our stand on principle as the ideal," replied Petzov in his mellow bass. "Women desires to have rights, to be independent, educated. She is oppressed, humiliated by the consciousness that this is impossible for her.
And I'm opposed and humiliated that they won't engage me at the foundling hospital as a wet nurse,"
the old prince said again, to the huge delight of Turovtsin, who, in his mirth, dropped his asparagus with a thick end in the sauce. Chapter 11. Everyone took part in the conversation except Kitty and Levin. At first, when they were talking of the influence that one people has on another, there rose to Levin's mind what he had to say on the subject. But these ideas, once of such importance in his eyes, seemed to come into his brain as in a dream, and had now not the slightest interest for him. It even struck him as strange that they should be so eager to talk of what was no use to anyone. One would have supposed that Kitty, too, would have been interested in what they were saying of the rights and education of women. How often she had mused on the subject, thinking of her friend abroad, Varenka, of her painful state of dependence. How often she had wondered about herself, and what would become of her if she didn't marry. And how often she had argued with her sister about it.
but it didn't interest her at all. She and Levin had a conversation of their own, yet not a conversation, but a sort of mysterious communication, which brought them every moment nearer, and stirred in both a sense of joyful terror before the unknown into which they were entering. At first, Levin, in answer to Kitty's question how he could have seen her last year in the carriage, told her how he had been coming home from the mowing along the high road and had met her. "It was very, very early in the morning. You were probably only just awake. Your mother was asleep in the corner. It was an exquisite morning. I was walking along, wondering who it could be in a four in hand. It was a splendid team of horses with bells, and in a second you flashed by, and I saw you at the window. You were sitting like this, holding the strings of your cap in both hands, and thinking very deeply about something," he said, smiling. "How I should like to know what you were thinking about then. Something important."
"Wasn't I dreadfully untidy?" she wondered. But seeing the smile of ecstasy these reminiscences called up, she felt that the impression she had made had been very good. She blushed and laughed with delight. "Really, I don't remember."
"How nicely Tchorotsin laughs," said Levin, admiring his moist eyes and shaking chest.
"Have you known him long?" asked Kitty.
"Oh, everyone knows him."
"And I see you think he's a horrid man."
"Not horrid, but worthless."
"Oh, you're wrong. And you must stop thinking so at once," said Kitty. "I used to have a very poor opinion of him, too. But he's an awfully nice and wonderfully good-hearted man. He has a heart of gold."
"How could you find out what sort of heart he has?"
"We're great friends. I know him very well. Last winter, soon after you came to see us," she said with a guilty and at the same time confiding smile. "All Dolly's children had scarlet fever, and he happened to come and see her. And just imagine," she said in a whisper, "he felt so sorry for her that he stayed and began to help her look after the children. Yes, and for 3 weeks he was with them and looked after the children like a nurse." "I'm telling Konstantin Dmitrievich about Tchorotsin and the scarlet fever," she said, bending over to her sister.
"Yes, it was wonderful, noble," said Dolly, glancing towards Tchorotsin, who had become aware they were talking of him, and smiling gently to him. Levin glanced once more at Tchorotsin, and wondered how it was he had not realized all this man's goodness before. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, and I'll never think ill of people again," he said gaily, genuinely expressing what he felt at the moment.
Chapter 12.
Connected with the conversation that had sprung up on the rights of women, there were certain questions as to the inequality of rights in marriages improper to discuss before the ladies. Pestsov had several times during dinner touched upon these questions, but Sergei Ivanovitch and Stepan Arkadyevitch carefully drew him off them. When they rose from the table and the ladies had gone out, Pestsov didn't follow them, but addressing Alexei Alexandrovitch, began to expound the chief ground of inequality. The inequality in marriage, in his opinion, lay in the fact that the infidelity of the wife and the infidelity of the husband are punished unequally, both by the law and by public opinion. Stepan Arkadyevitch went hurriedly up to Alexei Alexandrovitch and offered him a cigar.
"No, I don't smoke," Alexei Alexandrovitch answered calmly. And as though purposely wishing to show he was not afraid of the subject, he turned to Pestsov with a chilly smile.
"I imagine that such a view has a foundation in the very nature of things," he said, about to go into the drawing-room. But at this point, Tchorotsin suddenly and unexpectedly broke into the conversation, addressing Alexei Alexandrovitch. "You heard, perhaps, about Priyachnikov," said Tchorotsin, warmed up by the champagne he had drunk, and long waiting for an opportunity to break the silence that had weighed on him. "Vasya Priyachnikov," he said, with a good-natured smile on his damp red lips, addressing himself principally to the most important guest, Alexei Alexandrovitch. "They told me today he fought a duel with Kvitsky at Tver and killed him." "Just as it always seems that one bruises oneself on a sore place, so Stepan Arkadyevitch felt now that the conversation would, by ill luck, fall every moment on Alexei Alexandrovitch's sore spot. He would again have got his brother-in-law away, but Alexei Alexandrovitch himself inquired with curiosity.
"What did Priyatchnikov fight about?"
"His wife. Acted like a man, he did. Challenged and shot him."
"Ah," said Alexei Alexandrovitch indifferently, and lifting his eyebrows he went into the drawing-room. "How glad I am you've come," Dolly said with a frightened smile, meeting him in the outer drawing-room. "I must talk to you. Let's sit here." Alexei Alexandrovitch, with the same expression of indifference given him by his lifted eyebrows, sat down and smiled affectedly.
"It's fortunate," said he, "especially as I was meaning to ask you to excuse me and to be leaving. I have to start tomorrow."
Darya Alexandrovna was firmly convinced of Anna's innocence, and she felt herself growing pale and her lips quivering with anger at this cold, unfeeling man who was so calmly intending to ruin her innocent friend. "Alexei Alexandrovitch," she said, with desperate resolution, looking him in the face. "I asked you about Anna. You made me no answer. How is she?"
"She is, I believe, quite well, Darya Alexandrovna," replied Alexei Alexandrovitch, not looking at her.
"Alexei Alexandrovitch, forgive me. I have no right. But I love Anna as a sister, and esteem her. I beg, I beseech you to tell me what is wrong between you. What fault do you find with her?"
Alexei Alexandrovitch frowned, and almost closing his eyes, he lowered his head. "I presume that your husband has told you the grounds on which I consider it necessary to change my relations with Anna Arkadyevna, then?"
he said, not looking her in the face, but eyeing with displeasure Shishchabatsky, who was walking across the drawing-room. "I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I can't believe it," Dolly said, clasping her bony hands before her with a vigorous gesture. She rose quickly and laid her hand on Alexei Alexandrovitch's sleeve. "We shall be disturbed here. Come this way, please." Dolly's agitation had an effect on Alexei Alexandrovitch. He got up and submissively followed her to the classroom. They sat down at a table covered with an oilcloth cut in slits by penknives.
I don't believe it," Dolly said, trying to catch his glance that avoided her.
"One cannot disbelieve facts, Darya Alexandrovna," said he, with an emphasis on the word facts.
"But what has she done?" said Darya Alexandrovna. "What precisely has she done?"
"She has forsaken her duty and deceived her husband. That's what she has done," said he.
"No, no, it can't be. No, for God's sake, you are mistaken," said Dolly, putting her hands to her temples and closing her eyes.
Alexei Alexandrovitch smiled coldly with his lips alone, meaning to signify to her and himself the firmness of his conviction. But this warm defence, though it couldn't shake him, reopened his wound. He began to speak with greater heat.
"It's extremely difficult to be mistaken when a wife herself informs her husband of the fact, informs him that 8 years of her life and a son, all that's a mistake, and that she wants to begin life again," he said angrily with a snort.
"Anna and sin! I cannot connect them. I cannot believe it."
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said, now looking straight into Dolly's kindly, troubled face, and feeling that his tongue was being loosened in spite of himself, "I would give a great deal for doubt to be still possible. When I doubted, I was miserable, but it was better than now. When I doubted, I had hope. But now there is no hope, and still I doubt everything. I am in such doubt of everything that I even hate my son, and sometimes do not believe he is my son. I'm very unhappy."
He had no need to say that. Darya Alexandrovna had seen that as soon as he glanced into her face, and she felt sorry for him, and her faith in the innocence of her friend began to totter.
"Oh, this is awful, awful! But can it be true that you are resolved on a divorce?"
"I'm resolved on extreme measures. There's nothing else for me to do."
"Nothing else to do, nothing else to do," she replied with tears in her eyes. "Oh, no, don't say nothing else to do," she said.
"What is horrible in a trouble of this kind is that one cannot, as in any other, in loss, in death, bear one's trouble in peace, but that one must act," said he, as though guessing her thought. "One must get out of the humiliating position in which one is placed. One can't live à trois."
"I understand. I quite understand that," said Dolly, and her head sank. She was silent for a little, thinking of herself, of her own grief in her family. And all at once, with an impulsive movement, she raised her head and clasped her hands with an imploring gesture.
"But wait! You're a Christian. Think of her. What will become of her if you cast her off?"
"I have thought, Darya Alexandrovna. I have thought a great deal," said Alexei Alexandrovitch.
His face turned red in patches, and his dim eyes looked straight before him. Darya Alexandrovna at that moment pitied him with all her heart.
"That was what I did when she herself made known to me my humiliation. I left everything as before. I gave her a chance to reform. I tried to save her, and with what result? She would not regard the slightest request that she should observe decorum," he said, getting heated. "One may save anyone who doesn't want to be ruined. But if the whole nature is so corrupt, so depraved, that ruin itself seems to her salvation, what's to be done?"
"Anything. Only not divorce," answered Darya Alexandrovna.
"But what is anything?"
"No, it's awful. She'll be no one's wife. She'll be lost."
"What can I do?"
said Alexei Alexandrovitch, raising his shoulders and his eyebrows. The recollection of his wife's last act had so incensed him that he had become cold, as at the beginning of the conversation.
"I'm very grateful for your sympathy, but I must be going," he said, getting up.
"No, wait a minute. You mustn't ruin her. Wait. I'll tell you about myself. I was married, and my husband deceived me. In anger and jealousy, I would have given up everything. I would myself... But I came to myself again. And who did it? Anna saved me. And here I am, living on. The children are growing up. My husband has come back to his family and feels his fault. Is growing purer, better, and I live on. I have forgiven it, and you ought to forgive." Alexei Alexandrovitch heard her, but her words had no effect on him now. All the hatred of that day when he had resolved on a divorce had sprung up again in his soul. He shook himself and said in a shrill, loud voice,
"Forgive I cannot, and do not wish to, and I regard it as wrong. I've done everything for this woman, and she trampled it all in the mud to which she is akin. I'm not a spiteful man. I've never hated anyone. But I hate her with my whole soul, and I cannot even forgive her because I hate her too much for all the wrong she has done me," he said,
with tones of hatred in his voice. "Love them that hate you," Darya Alexandrovna whispered timorously. Alexei Alexandrovitch smiled contemptuously. That he knew long ago, but it couldn't be applied to his case.
"Love them that hate you, but to love those one hates is impossible. Forgive me for having troubled you. Everyone has enough to bear in his own grief."
And regaining his self-possession, Alexei Alexandrovitch quietly took leave and went away. Chapter 13. When they rose from the table, Levin would have liked to follow Kitty into the drawing-room, but he was afraid she might dislike this, because he would be too obviously paying her attention. He remained in the little ring of men, taking part in the general conversation, and without looking at Kitty, was aware of her movements, her looks, and the place where she was in the drawing-room. He did at once, and without the smallest effort, keep the promise he had made her, always to think well of all men, and to like everyone always.
The conversation fell on the village commune, in which Pestsov saw a sort of special principle called by him the choral principle. Levin didn't agree with Pestsov, nor with his brother, who had a special attitude of his own, both admitting and not admitting the significance of the Russian commune. But he talked to them, simply trying to reconcile and soften their differences. He was not in the least interested in what he said himself, and even less so in what they said. All he wanted was that they and everyone should be happy and contented. He knew now the one thing of importance, and that one thing was at first there in the drawing-room, and then began moving across and came to a stop at the door. Without turning around, he felt the eyes fixed on him, and the smile, and he couldn't help turning around. She was standing in the doorway with Shchebatsky, looking at him.
"I thought you were going toward the piano," said he, going up to her. "That's something I miss in the country. Music."
"No,
we only came to fetch you and thank you,"
she said, rewarding him with a smile that was like a gift, "for coming."
"Why do they want to argue? No one ever convinces anyone, you know."
"Yes, that's true," said Levin. "It generally happens that one argues warmly simply because one can't make out what one's opponent wants to prove."
Levin had often noticed in discussions between the most intelligent people that after enormous efforts and an enormous expenditure of logical subtleties and words, the disputants finally came to be aware that what they had so long been struggling to prove to one another had long ago, from the beginning of the argument, been known to both, but that they liked different things and would not define what they liked for fear of its being attacked. He had often had the experience of suddenly, in a discussion, grasping what it was his opponent liked, and at once liking it too. And immediately he found himself agreeing, and then all arguments fell away as useless. Sometimes, too, he had experienced the opposite, expressing at last what he liked himself, which he was devising arguments to defend, and chancing to express it well and genuinely, he had found his opponent at once agreeing and ceasing to dispute his position. He tried to say this. She knitted her brow, trying to understand. But as soon as he began to illustrate his meaning, she understood at once.
"I know. One must find out what he is arguing for, what is precious to him. Then one can..."
She had completely guessed and expressed his badly expressed idea. Levin smiled joyfully. He was struck by this transition from the confused, verbose discussion with Pestsov and his brother to this laconic, clear, almost wordless communication of the most complex ideas. Shchebatsky moved away from them, and Kitty, going up to a card table, sat down, and picking up the chalk, began drawing spirals over the new green cloth. They began again on the subject that had been started at dinner, the liberty and occupations of women. Levin was of the opinion of Darya Alexandrovna that a girl who didn't marry should find a woman's duties in a family. He supported this view by the fact that no family can get on without women to help, that in every family, poor or rich, there are and must be nurses, either relations or hired.
"No," said Kitty, blushing, but looking at him all the more boldly with her truthful eyes, "a girl may be in such a situation that she cannot live in the family without humiliation, while she herself..."
At the hint, he understood her.
"Oh, yes," he said. "Yes, yes, yes. You're right. You're right."
And he saw all that Pestsov had been maintaining at dinner about the freedom of women, simply from getting a glimpse of the terror of an old maid's existence and its humiliation in Kitty's heart. And loving her, he felt that terror and humiliation, and at once gave up his arguments. A silence followed. She was still drawing with the chalk on the table. Her eyes were shining with a soft light. Under the influence of her mood, he felt in all his being a continually growing tension of happiness.
"Oh, I've scribbled all over the table," she said,
and laying down the chalk, she made a movement as though to get up.
"What? Shall I be left alone, without her?" he thought with horror, and he took the chalk. "Wait a minute," he said, sitting down to the table. "I've long wanted to ask you one thing.
He looked straight into her caressing, though frightened, eyes.
"Please, ask it."
"Here," he said. And he wrote the initial letters WYTMICNBDTMNOT. These letters meant, "When you told me it could never be, did that mean never or then?" There seemed no likelihood that she could make out this complicated sentence, but he looked at her as though his life depended on her understanding the words. She glanced at him seriously, then leaned her puckered brow on her hands and began to read. Once or twice she stole a look at him as though asking him, "Is it what I think?" "I understand," she said, flushing a little.
"What is this word?"
he said, pointing to the N that stood for never.
"It means never," she said, "but that's not true."
He quickly rubbed out what he had written, gave her the chalk, and stood up. She wrote TICNAD.
Dolly was completely comforted in the depression caused by her conversation with Alexei Alexandrovich when she caught sight of the two figures. Kitty, with a chalk in her hand, with a shy and happy smile, looking up at Levin, and his handsome figure bending over the table with glowing eyes, fastened one minute on the table, the next on her. He was suddenly radiant. He had understood. It meant, "Then I could not answer differently." He glanced at her questioningly, timidly.
"Only then?"
"Yes," her smile answered. "And N? And now?" he asked.
"Well, read this. I'll tell you what I would like so much."
She wrote the initial letters IYCFAFWH. This meant, "If you could forget and forgive what happened." He snatched the chalk with nervous, trembling fingers, and breaking it, wrote the initial letters of the following phrase. "I have nothing to forget and to forgive. I have never ceased to love you." She glanced at him with a smile that didn't waver.
"I understand," she said in a whisper.
He sat down and wrote a long phrase. She understood it all, and without asking him, "Is it this?" took the chalk and at once answered. For a long while he couldn't understand what she had written, and often looked into her eyes. He was stupefied with happiness. He couldn't supply the words she had meant, but in her charming eyes, beaming with happiness, he saw all he needed to know. And he wrote three letters. But he'd hardly finished writing when she read them over her arm, and herself finished and wrote the answer, "Yes."
"You're playing secretaire," said the old prince, "but we must really be getting along if you want to be in time at the theatre."
Levin got up and escorted Kitty to the door. In their conversation, everything had been said. It had been said that she loved him, and that she would tell her father and mother that he would come tomorrow morning.
Chapter 14. When Kitty had gone, and Levin was left alone, he felt such uneasiness without her, and such an impatient longing to get as quickly as possible to tomorrow morning, when he would see her again and be plighted to her forever, that he felt afraid, as though of death, of those 14 hours that he had to get through without her. It was essential for him to be with someone to talk to, so as not to be left alone, to kill time. Stepan Arkadyevitch would have been the companion most congenial to him, but he was going out, he said, to a soiree, in reality to the ballet. Levin had time only to tell him he was happy and that he loved him, and would never, never forget what he had done for him. The eyes and the smile of Stepan Arkadyevitch showed Levin that he comprehended that feeling correctly.
"Oh, so it's not time to die yet," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, pressing Levin's hand with emotion.
"No," said Levin.
Darya Alexandrovna, too, as she said goodbye to him, seemed to congratulate him, saying, "How glad I am you've met Kitty again. One must value old friends." Levin didn't like these words of Darya Alexandrovna's. She couldn't understand how lofty and beyond her it all was, and she ought not to have dared to allude to it. Levin said goodbye to them, but not to be left alone. He attached himself to his brother.
"Where are you going?"
"I'm going to a meeting."
"Well, I'll come with you, can I?"
"What for?"
"Yes, come along," said Sergei Ivanovitch, smiling.
"What's the matter with you today?"
"With me?
Happiness is the matter with me," said Levin, letting down the window of the carriage they were driving in.
"You don't mind?
It's so stifling."
"It's happiness is the matter with me.
Why is it you've never married?"
Sergei Ivanovitch smiled.
"I'm very glad. She seems a nice g—"
Sergei Ivanovitch was beginning.
"Don't say it! Don't say it!" shouted Levin, clutching at the collar of his fur coat with both hands and muffling him up in it. "She's a nice girl," were such simple, humble words, so out of harmony with his feelings.
Sergei Ivanovitch laughed outright a merry laugh, which was rare with him.
"Well, anyway, I may say that I'm very glad of it." "That you may do tomorrow, tomorrow, and nothing more." "Nothing, nothing. Silence," said Levin. And muffling him once more in his fur coat, he added, "I like you so much. Well, is it possible for me to be present at the meeting?"
"Of course it is."
"What's your discussion about today?" asked Levin, never ceasing smiling.
They arrived at the meeting. Levin heard the secretary hesitatingly read the minutes, which he obviously didn't himself understand. But Levin saw from this secretary's face what a good, nice, kind-hearted person he was. This was evident from his confusion and embarrassment in reading the minutes. Then the discussion began. They were disputing about the misappropriation of certain sums and the laying of certain pipes, and Sergei Ivanovitch was very cutting to two members, and said something at a great length with an air of triumph. And another member, scribbling something on a bit of paper, began timidly at first, but afterwards answered him very venomously and charmingly. And then Chiavsky, he was there too, said something very handsomely and nobly. Levin listened to them, and saw clearly that these missing sums and these pipes were not anything real, and that these people were not at all angry, but were all the nicest, kindest people, and everything was as happy and charming as possible between them. They did no harm to anyone, and were all enjoying it. What struck Levin was that he could see through them all today, and from little, almost imperceptible signs, he knew the soul of each, and saw distinctly that they were all good at heart. And they were all extremely fond of Levin, in particular, that day. That was evident from the way they spoke to him, from the friendly, affectionate way even those he didn't know looked at him.
"Well, did you like it?" Sergei Ivanovitch asked him.
"Very much. I never supposed it was so interesting. Marvellous. Splendid."
Chiavsky went up to Levin and invited him to have tea with him. Levin was utterly at a loss to comprehend or recall what it was he had disliked in Chiavsky, what he had failed to find in him. He was an intelligent and wonderfully good-hearted man.
"Most delighted," he said,
and asked after his wife and sister-in-law. And from a strange association of ideas, because in his imagination the idea of Chiavsky's sister-in-law was connected with marriage, it occurred to him that there was no one to whom he could more suitably speak of his happiness, and he was very glad to go and see them. Chiavsky questioned him about his improvements on his estate, presupposing, as he always did, that there was no possibility of doing anything not done already in Europe. And now this didn't in the least annoy Levin. On the contrary, he felt that Chiavsky was right, that the whole business was of little value, and he saw the wonderful softness and consideration with which Chiavsky avoided fully expressing his correct view. The ladies of the Chiavsky household were particularly delightful. It seemed to Levin that they knew all about it already, and sympathized with him, saying nothing merely from delicacy. He stayed with them 1 hour, two, three, talking of all subjects but the one that filled his heart, and didn't observe that he was boring them dreadfully, and that it was long past their bedtime. Chiavsky went with him into the hall, yawning and wondering at the strange mood his friend was in. It was past 1 o'clock. Levin went back to his hotel, and was dismayed at the thought that all alone now with his impatience, he had 10 hours still left to get through. The servant, whose turn it was to be up all night, lighted his candles and would have gone away, but Levin stopped him. This servant, Yegor, whom Levin had noticed before, struck him as a very intelligent, excellent, and above all, good-hearted man.
"Well, Yegor, it's hard work not sleeping, isn't it? One's got to put up with it. It's part of our work, you see. In a gentleman's house it's easier, but then here one makes more."
It appeared that Yegor had a family, 3 boys and a daughter, a seamstress, whom he wanted to marry to a salesman in a saddler's shop. Levin, on hearing this, informed Yegor that, in his opinion, in marriage the main thing was love, and that with love one would always be happy, for happiness lies only within oneself. Yegor listened attentively, and obviously quite took in Levin's idea, but by way of assent to it, he enunciated, greatly to Levin's surprise, the observation that when he had lived with good masters, he'd always been satisfied with his masters, and now was perfectly satisfied with his employer, though he was a Frenchman.
"Wonderfully good-hearted fellow," thought Levin. "Well, but you yourself, Yegor, when you got married, did you love your wife?" "Aye, and why not?" responded Yegor.
And Levin saw that Yegor, too, was in an excited state, and intended to express all his most heartfelt emotions.
"My life, too, has been a wonderful one, from a child up—" he was beginning with flashing eyes, apparently catching Levin's enthusiasm, just as people catch yawning.
But at that moment a ring was heard. Yegor departed, and Levin was left alone. He had eaten scarcely anything at dinner, had refused tea and supper at Shiavsky's, but he was incapable of thinking of supper. He hadn't slept the previous night, but was incapable of thinking of sleep either. His room was cold, but he was oppressed by heat. He opened both the movable panes in his window and sat down to the table opposite the open panes. Over the snow-covered roofs could be seen a gilt fretwork cross decorated with chains, and above it the rising triangle of the charioteer with the yellowish light of Capella. He gazed at the cross, then at the stars, drank in the fresh, freezing air that flowed evenly into the room, and followed, as though in a dream, the images and memories that rose in his imagination. At 4 o'clock he heard steps in the passage and peeped out at the door. It was the gambler, Miaskin, whom he knew, coming from the club. He walked gloomily, frowning and coughing. "Poor, unlucky fellow," thought Levin, and tears came into his eyes from love and pity for this man. He would have talked with him, comforted him, but remembering that he had nothing but his shirt on, he changed his mind and sat down again at the open pane to bathe in the cold air and gaze at the exquisite lines of the cross, silent but full of meaning for him, and the rising bright yellow star. At 7 o'clock there was a noise of people polishing the floors and bells ringing for service, and Levin felt that he was beginning to get frozen. He closed the pane, washed, dressed, and went out into the street.
Chapter 15.
The streets were still empty. Levin went to the Shishchabatskys. The visitors' doors were closed, and everyone was asleep. He walked back, went into his room again, and asked for coffee. The day-servant, not Yegor this time, brought it to him. Levin would have entered into conversation with him, but a bell rang for the servant, and he went out. Levin tried to drink coffee, and put a piece of roll in his mouth. But his mouth was quite at a loss as to what to do with it. Levin, spitting out the roll, put on his coat and went out again for a walk. It was 9 o'clock when he reached the Shishchabatsky's steps the second time. In the house they were just up, and the cook came out to go marketing. He had to get through at least 2 hours more. All that night and morning Levin lived perfectly unconsciously, and felt perfectly lifted out of the conditions of material life. He had eaten nothing for a whole day, he hadn't slept for 2 nights, had spent several hours undressed in the frozen air, and felt not simply fresher and stronger than ever, but utterly independent of his body. He moved without effort of his muscles, and felt as if he could do anything. He was convinced he could fly upward, or lift the corner of the house if need be. He spent the remainder of the time in the street, incessantly looking at his watch and gazing about him. And what he saw then, he never saw again. Especially the children going to school, the bluish pigeons flying down from the roof to the sidewalk, and the little loaves covered with flour thrust out by an unseen hand, all touched him. Those loaves, those pigeons, and those two boys were not earthly creatures. It all happened at the same time. A boy ran toward a dove and glanced smiling at Levin. The dove, with a whirr of her wings, darted away, flashing in the sun amid grains of snow that quivered in the air, while from a little window there came a smell of fresh-baked bread, and the loaves were put out. All of this was so extraordinarily nice that Levin laughed and cried with delight.
Going a long way round by Gazetny Lane and Kislovka, he went back again to the hotel, and putting his watch before him, he sat down to wait for 12 o'clock. In the next room they were talking about some sort of machines, and swindling, and coughing their morning coughs. They didn't realize that the hand was near 12. The hand reached it. Levin went out onto the steps. The sleigh drivers obviously knew all about it. They crowded around Levin with happy faces, quarrelling among themselves and offering their services. Trying not to offend the other sleigh drivers and promising to drive with them too, Levin took one and told him to drive to the Shishchabatskys. The sleigh driver was splendid in a white shirt collar sticking out over his overcoat and fitting tightly around his strong, thick red neck. The sleigh was high and comfortable, although one the likes of which Levin never drove in after, and the horse was a good one and tried to gallop, but didn't seem to move. The driver knew the Shishchabatskys' house, and drew up at the entrance with a curve of his arm and a "Whoa!" especially indicative of respect for his fare. The Shishchabatskys' hall porter certainly knew all about it. This was evident from the smile in his eyes and the way he said, "Well, it's a long time since you've been to see us, Konstantin Dmitrievich." Not only did he know all about it, he was unmistakably delighted and making efforts to conceal his joy. Looking into his kindly old eyes, Levin realized something new even in his happiness. "Are they up?"
"Please walk in. Leave it there," he said, smiling as Levin would have come back to take his hat.
That meant something.
"To whom shall I announce, Your Honor?" asked the footman.
The footman, though a young man, and one of the new school of footmen, a dandy, was a very kind-hearted, good fellow, and he, too, knew all about it.
"The princess, the prince, the young princess," said Levin.
The first person he saw was Mademoiselle Linon. She walked across the room, and her ringlets and her face were beaming. He'd only just spoken to her, when suddenly he heard the rustle of a skirt at the door, and Mademoiselle Linon vanished from Levin's eyes, and a joyful terror came over him at the nearness of his happiness. Mademoiselle Linon was in great haste, and leaving him, went out at the other door. As soon as she had gone, swift, swift light steps sounded on the parquet, and his bliss, his life, himself, what was best in himself, what he had so long sought and longed for, was quickly, so quickly approaching him. She didn't walk, but seemed by some unseen force to float to him. He saw nothing but her clear, truthful eyes, frightened by the same bliss of love that flooded his heart. Those eyes were shining nearer and nearer, blinding him with their light of love. She stopped close to him, touching him. Her hands rose and dropped on his shoulders. She had done all she could. She had run up to him and given herself up entirely, shyly, blissfully. He put his arms around her and pressed his lips to her mouth that sought his kiss. She, too, had not slept all night and had been expecting him all morning. Her mother and father had consented without qualification and were happy in her happiness. She had been waiting for him. She wanted to be the first to tell him of her happiness and his. She had got ready to see him alone
and had been delighted at the idea, and had been shy and ashamed, and didn't know herself what she was doing. She had heard his steps and voice, and had waited at the door for Mademoiselle Linon to go. Mademoiselle Linon had gone away. Without thinking, without asking herself how and what, she'd gone up to him and did as she was doing.
"Let's go to Mama," she said, taking him by the hand.
For a long while he could say nothing, not so much because he was afraid of desecrating the loftiness of his emotion by a word, as that every time he tried to say something, instead of words, he felt that tears of happiness were welling up. He took her hand and kissed it. "Can it be true?" he said at last in a choked voice. "I can't believe you love me, dear." She smiled at that "dear," and at the timidity with which he glanced at her. "Yes," she said, significantly, deliberately. "I am so happy." Not letting go his hands, she went into the drawing-room. The princess, seeing them, breathed quickly, and immediately began to cry, and then immediately began to laugh, and with a vigorous step Levin had not expected, ran up to him, and hugging his head, kissed him, wetting his cheeks with her tears.
"So it's all settled. I'm glad. Love her. I am glad. Kitty."
"You've not been long settling things," said the old prince, trying to seem unmoved. But Levin noticed that his eyes were wet when he turned to him. "I've long, always wished for this," said the prince, taking Levin by the arm and drawing him toward himself.
"Even when this little scatterbrain thought..."
"Papa!"
shrieked Kitty, and shut his mouth with her hands.
"Well, I won't," he said. "I'm very, very... Oh, what a fool I am."
He embraced Kitty, kissed her face, her hand, her face again, and made the sign of the cross over her. And there came over Levin a new feeling of love for this man, till then so little known to him, when he saw how slowly and tenderly Kitty kissed his fleshy hand. Chapter 16. The princess sat in her armchair, silent and smiling. The prince sat down beside her. Kitty stood by her father's chair, still holding his hand. All was silent. The princess was the first to put everything into words, and to translate all thoughts and feelings into practical questions. And all equally felt this strange and painful for the first minute.
"When is it to be? We must have the benediction and an announcement. And when's the wedding to be? What do you think, Alexander?"
"Here he is," said the old prince, pointing to Levin. "He's the principal person in the matter."
"When?"
said Levin, blushing.
"Tomorrow. If you ask me, I should say the benediction today and the wedding tomorrow."
"Come, mon cher, that's nonsense."
"Well, in a week." "He's quite mad."
"No, why so?" "Well, upon my word," said the mother, smiling, delighted at his haste. "How about the trousseau?"
"Will there really be a trousseau and all that?" Levin thought with horror.
"But can the trousseau and the benediction and all that, can it spoil my happiness? Nothing can spoil it."
He glanced at Kitty, and noticed that she was not in the least, not in the very least, disturbed by the idea of the trousseau.
"Then it must be all right," he thought. "Oh, I know nothing about it. I only said what I would like,"
he said apologetically.
"We'll talk it over then. The benediction and announcement can take place now. That's very well."
The princess went up to her husband, kissed him, and was about to leave. But he held on to her, embraced her, and tenderly as a young lover, kissed her several times, smiling. The old people were obviously muddled for a moment, and didn't quite know whether it was they who were in love again, or their daughter. When the prince and princess had gone, Levin went up to his betrothed and took her hand. He was self-possessed now, and could speak, and he had a great deal he wanted to tell her. But he said not all what he had to say.
"I knew it would be so.
I never hoped for it, and yet in my heart I was always sure, he said. I believe that it was ordained.
And I, she said, even when...
She stopped and went on again, looking at him resolutely with her truthful eyes.
Even when I thrust from me my happiness, I always loved you alone. But I was carried away. I ought to tell you... Can you forgive it?
Perhaps it was for the best. You will have to forgive me so much. I ought to tell you...
This was one of the things he had meant to speak about. He had resolved from the first to tell her two things. That he was not chaste, as she was, and that he was not a believer. It was agonizing, but he considered he ought to tell her both these facts.
No, not now, later, he said.
Very well, later, but you must certainly tell me. I'm not afraid of anything. I want to know everything, now it's settled.
He added, settle that you'll take me, whatever I may be. You won't give me up, yes?
Yes, yes.
Their conversation was interrupted by Mademoiselle Ninon, who, with an affected but tender smile, came to congratulate her favourite pupil. Before she had gone, the servants came in with their congratulations. Then relations arrived, and there began that state of blissful absurdity from which Levin didn't emerge till the day after his wedding. Levin was in a continual state of awkwardness and discomfort, but the intensity of his happiness kept on increasing. He felt continually that a great deal was being expected of him, what he didn't know, and he did everything he was told, and it all gave him happiness. He had thought his engagement would have nothing about it like others, that the ordinary conditions of engaged couples would spoil his special happiness. But it ended in his doing exactly as other people did, and his happiness being only increased thereby, and becoming more and more special, more and more unlike anything that had ever happened.
"Now we shall have sweets to eat," said Mademoiselle Linon,
and Levin drove off to buy sweets.
"Well, I'm very glad," said Sviazhsky. "I advise you to get the bouquets from Fomin's."
"Oh, are they needed?"
And he drove to Fomin's. His brother offered to lend him money, as he would have so many expenses, presents to give.
"Oh, are presents needed?"
And he galloped to Fulda's. And at the confectioner's, and at Fomin's, and at Fulda's, he saw that he was expected, that they were pleased to see him, and prided themselves on his happiness, just as everyone whom he had to deal with during those days. What was extraordinary was not only that everyone liked him, but that even people previously unsympathetic, cold, and callous were enthusiastic over him, gave way to him in everything, treated his feeling with tenderness and delicacy, and shared his conviction that he was the happiest man in the world because his betrothed was beyond perfection. Kitty, too, felt the same thing. When Countess Nordstrom ventured to hint that she had hoped for something better, Kitty was so angry, and proved so conclusively that nothing in the world could be better than Levin, that Countess Nordstrom had to admit it, and in Kitty's presence she never met Levin without a smile of ecstatic admiration. The confession he had promised was the one painful incident of this time. He consulted the old prince, and with his sanction gave Kitty his diary, in which there was written the confession that tortured him. He had written this diary at the time with a view to his future wife. Two things caused him anguish, his lack of purity and his lack of faith. His confession of unbelief passed unnoticed. She was religious, had never doubted the truths of religion, but his external unbelief didn't affect her in the least. Through love she knew all his soul, and in his soul she saw what she wanted. And that such a state of soul should be called unbelieving was to her a matter of no account. The other confession set her weeping bitterly. Levin, not without an inner struggle, handed her his diary. He knew that between him and her there could not be, and should not be, secrets, and so he had decided that so it must be. But he had not realized what an effect it would have on her, he'd not put himself in her place. It was only when, the same evening he came to their house before the theatre, went into her room, and saw her tear-stained, pitiful, sweet face, miserable with suffering he had caused, and nothing could undo, he felt the abyss that separated his shameful past from her dove-like purity, and was appalled at what he had done.
"Take them away. Take these dreadful books," she said, pushing away the notebooks lying before her on the table. "Why did you give them to me?" "No, it was better anyway," she added, touched by his despairing face. "But it's awful, awful."
His head sank, and he was silent. He could say nothing. "You can't forgive me," he whispered.
"Yes, I forgive you. But it's terrible."
But his happiness was so immense that this confession didn't shatter it. It only added another shade to it. She forgave him, but from that time, more than ever, he considered himself unworthy of her, morally bowed down lower than ever before her, and prized more highly than ever his undeserved happiness.